What's good, everybody? Welcome to Origin Story, the podcast that interviews creators about where they came from to understand how they got here. My name is Philip Russell, and I am with my co-host,
Ben Thorpe.
And Ben, today we talked to some people that we really love, the folks at $2 Radio, Eric Obanoff and Eliza Obanoff, the founders of $2 Radio, which is a book publishing company, of which we've interviewed, I think, two authors on the podcast at this point, Gina Nutt of Night Rooms, and more recently, John Elizabeth Stintzy with their book, My Volcano. It was really cool to finally meet these people behind some of the books that we love, and it was a really fun conversation.
Yeah, Phil, you know, we have been reading a lot of $2 books for a while now. Maybe you should kind of tee us up just in terms of like how you stumbled across the press, because I ended up reading a bunch of their books because you were like, yo, $2 Radio, cool press.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely discovered them when I was in Ohio for my master's, because they're based in Columbus, Ohio. And I assume the first book I read of theirs was what is it? They don't kill us.
They can't kill us until they kill us.
Yeah, they can't kill us until they kill us. Yeah. By Hanif Abdurraqib. It's like a music kind of personal essay collection. So each essay is based around a particular like band or musician, and kind of Hanif is interweaving his own personal connection as well as like political, socio-cultural kind of insights into how he relates to these different musicians. Really, really popular book now. I mean, I think even during our conversation, they say it's sold like over 75,000 copies or something like that, which is a lot for like these smaller indie presses. And, you know, their books are fairly cheap and like just really experimental, challenging, and interesting. So that's kind of how I discovered them. And I'm sure, yeah, I kind of was just knocking on everybody's door, including yours, Ben, of like, hey, check out these books. They're really cool.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the other thing that kind of stands out, you're kind of mentioning there, you know, their bit as they kind of self-describe it is, you know, looking for stuff that's a little bit edgier, a little bit darker, a little bit more experimental. But, you know, especially when you have, you've spent time in an English program, or maybe you just read a lot. I'm not going to offer too many of my, you know, bad literary takes, but I often feel like if you read enough contemporary fiction, it all starts to blend together. You're like, I am reading the same stuff with a similar prose style. It becomes hard to miss that the kind of house style that is out there kind of permeates a lot of stuff. And so it can be hard to find stuff that's really, truly weird, strange, off the beaten path. And so a press like this becomes really interesting, I think, where you're like, oh, this is weird. This is something that I haven't read anywhere else, and I'm probably not going to. And so I think during this conversation, we also get into the logistics of that, because I think you can ask a question about like, well, like, how do you market something that is weirder and stranger and is, I think, more challenging in some ways? And what does that mean as a publisher to be able to pursue stuff like that, as opposed to, you know, some of the big four or big five publishers who at the end of the day are like looking for stuff that is going to, I think, read pretty easy and be marketable?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if anything, I think $2 Radio's books was the first time where, you know, again, as people who have been in like these programs and were writing work with the intention of maybe having a book or some kind of bigger project someday, you know, when you think of the big publishers like Random House and all that, it can feel very like, oh, unattainable. And not to say that like getting a book published at $2 Radio is necessarily any easier, but if anything, it just kind of made me feel like some of the more weird things I was writing actually could find a place to be published. And I mean, also like, I liked that they have a lot of books that are like really short. I mean, they have plenty of books that are longer, but one thing I really liked is some of my favorite books by them are like these really short pieces. And I think when you're in grad programs, sometimes it can feel like, oh, you can't really have things that are like kind of on more on the shorter end when you're thinking about a longer project. So talking to them about that and just kind of like their ethos in terms of finding work was really interesting. So, you know, in this conversation, we get into things around like, you know, how the press came to be, from Eric and Eliza working service industry jobs to starting this one of the bigger indie presses in the country, as well as like why it's important for them to, you know, take unsolicited submissions still, which is something that we've already touched upon in their press when we talked to Gina Nutt in our first season. So, yeah, I think this conversation is really interesting and gives you a look into how the publishing industry works. And yeah, they just had a lot of really fun stories to tell us about, you know, this whole concept we've been talking about of like making the dream a reality and kinds of the sacrifices you need to make in order to get there. So yeah, really cool conversation, and we'll just jump right into it.
Eric Obanoff and Eliza Wood Obanoff describe themselves as an idealistic young married couple with a love of books who now live in Columbus, Ohio, with their two children and their brick-and-mortar indie bookstore. The two founded $2 Radio as a family-run outfit in 2005 with the mission to reaffirm the cultural and artistic spirit of the publishing industry. Both of you, thank you so much for coming and talking to us today. I think one of the big questions that I want to get to and tee you up with is, you know, Phil and I have been reading your books on and off for years now, and I think it's fair to say that we really enjoy what $2 is doing. One of the things kind of broadly that feels like is standing out, and you can correct me, is that, you know, I feel like it's placing itself in a place that's maybe different from a lot of contemporary lit, where it's allowing for things that feel a little bit more daring, feel like they're not afraid to be more kind of complicated in some ways. And so I'm wondering if you can just talk about what is the ethos of what makes a book that $2 Radio is going to pursue or is interested in, and how is it different from, you know, what some of the kind of bigger books in the publishing industry like are?
Well, I think especially early on, someone told us it was a writer that we published, Joshua Moore, and I think he was originally quoting someone else too. But he said, you know, no one recommends like an okay book to their friends. Like, you don't finish reading a book and you're like, hey, that was pretty average. Like, I'm going to tell all my friends about it. They only recommend like really great books. And so that is something that we've always kept with us and internalized and try to approach each of our books in that way, where it's like, it's okay if it's polarizing. It's okay if you hate this, but you should feel something after reading this book. And so that is something that's very, I think, vital to our mission, because it doesn't benefit an independent publisher to just be publishing stuff that could come out from any of the big presses. So we're looking for work that's like different, distinctive. If they're putting a familiar spin on a story that we've already read, they have to do it in sort of like a really creative, brilliant way that stands out from the rest of the field.
Yeah, I mean, I think some books that stick out to me are like Some of Us Are Very Hungry Now by Andre Perry, or very recently, My Volcano by John Elizabeth Stinsey. You know, these books utilize highly experimental formal choices that I could imagine, like, when you get these submissions, they can kind of feel like, whoa, how do I navigate responding to this and working with this text? I'm curious, like, what it's like for you all in that process. Like, you've accepted the manuscript, or you're thinking about accepting the manuscript. How do you go about like that editing process, or the process that's leading up to publication and getting the book into the form that it needs to be?
Well, Eric is the acquisitions editor, to use like industry talk. So
let's go.
he exclusively reads the books we publish, and intentionally I function as kind of like editor too. So if a book needs a lot of work, which occasionally will be the case, where we do a lot of restructuring, Eric will have eyes on it first, do his work, and then I won't take any peek at it at all, so that I can read it with fresh eyes and try to catch anything that, if you're restructuring things, you know, a character that got cut might still be in there somewhere. So catching things like that. And then I also do the copy editing. So Eric is the person who our brand is based off of. It's Eric's taste in literature. And that's why we've been successful, is because I think there's like a very pinpointed like taste that is coming through and that you're seeing. So books as different as My Volcano and Andre Perry's book, they are pretty different books. But then when you look at our whole catalog as a whole, you can see that there's kind of these connecting threads that he mentioned, like extremely voice-driven, confident, edgy, usually tending towards the dark. So yeah, our brand is Eric's Taste in Books. It's like really simple.
You know, I'm wondering if, you know, as you've kind of defined what the voice or what the kinds of books that you look for are going to be, has it gotten to a place where people will say, oh, $2 is the publication that we want to go to?
Well, I think in general, like I guess in terms of like wooing authors, it's a lot easier than it was years ago. I mean, when we were first starting out, we didn't have a distributor and we were like in our early to mid 20s and didn't really know what we were doing. We just had like, you know, the spark of this idea and an extreme passion for books. But I guess like one of the stories I tell about that time when we were first starting out was getting Rudolf Wurlitzer to agree to publish with us. He hadn't published a novel in 20 years. And so the publishing industry has a really short attention span. If you haven't published anything in like 3 to 5 years, you know, you're dead to them in terms of like having any kind of like sales history or clout. And so Rudy had he had like super powerful agent who was shopping around this novel manuscript called The Drop Edge of Yonder. And so I read it and absolutely adored it. And Rudy was responsive, and we didn't have a distributor or anything like that. It was ridiculous. And so then Rudy was like, we spoke on the phone a couple of times, and then he's like, I'm going to be in New York staying at a friend's house. If you want to meet up and we can talk about this. And so I met him. It was, we were living in New York at the time, living in Brooklyn. Met up with Rudy. He didn't tell me who his friend was, but it was Philip Glass. And so I showed up to his house and I was like 24 or 25. Like everything was in my backpack. Like I didn't dress up or anything like that. And he's like, yeah, come on in. And introduced me to Philip Glass. And then we went down, you know, into the lower floor, and we were talking about The Drop Edge of Yonder and what we wanted to do with $2 Radio and all that stuff. And the whole time in the room above us, Philip Glass was playing the piano. And it was just like the most insane experience. So Rudy, you know, agreed to publish with us. And that was a really big sort of like milestone. And then we ended up getting more substantial distribution as a result of that. And then we released that book and it did really well. But then all the timing was wonky too, because that was like spring of 2008. And then that fall, the Great Recession hit. Everyone was talking about e-readers, the death of print, all this crap. So we never got to experience that sort of like easy sailing golden days of publishing. It's always been
Can you kind of talk about like those are the early days? What was the initial dream, and maybe how did that start? I was reading an interview that you two did with Lit Hub about you kind of moved to Columbus, started this published company, essentially I think broke. What did this look like, and what was the kind of vision that you had in those early days?
We were actually in San Diego, broke, but. Like all of it's
we've been broke in several places.
We were broke because all of our money was going to living a few blocks away from the beach. Because we were you know, 23-ish, and that was our priority at that point in time. So we were doing service industry jobs, just trying to kind of figure out what was going to happen because we had finished college. And yeah, so that's where the company started. Was during, we lived in San Diego for a total of 2 years and started the company there. And it was Eric's idea.
Well, there's, I mean, if you, the, I mean, we,
it was my idea to have a baby. And it was his idea to start a company. So we started a company.
I mean, we were reading a ton, and we were, you know, that was sort of like a shared passion of ours, was like reading and passing out books with one another. So it was pretty like informative in terms of like common ground for our relationship early on, was set to be sharing these books that we really loved. And so I was picking up a lot of books published by these small presses like Akashic and Soft Skull. And Small Beer. And so at the time I would go to a bookstore and I wouldn't look for like author names or whatever the latest book was. I would just be looking for the little logo from like a small press that I recognize. And then I just buy whatever that was. And so, you know, discovering that whole like niche universe of these small presses, you know, it's like the way that you would trust an indie record label like Matador or Merge or Jag Jaguar or whatever. It's like, you know, their taste, and you know that you can trust their inclinations. And so that was kind of like how we wanted to approach $2 Radio as a press, but also sort of like how we imagined conceiving it or how it would exist. But also, if you look at the publishing industry as a whole over the last, like since World War II, because there's been so much corporate consolidation from World War II until the 90s, you know, right now there's been even more consolidation in the last couple of years, where we're really looking at there's four major corporations that make up like 80%+ of book sales in the US. And so the flip side of that is it's created an environment over the last quarter century for just small publishers to pop up out of nowhere and get like really, really incredible work and publish it and craft this identity out of nowhere.
Which is how we got Rudy Wurlitzer's novel, The Drop Edge of Yonder, in the first place. And there was another book that we read by Andre Schifrin called
The Business of Books.
The Business of Books, which was really inspiring to Eric, and then he passed it on to me and I read it. And I was also inspired because it's just kind of like the underdogs, you know, like rising up to the challenge. And that, so there was just some, that those were like some of the magic ingredients that led to the idea of like, we're gonna start our own family press, was a shared interest, a shared taste in books, a vision for what we wanted to publish. And then just, we're really kind of independently minded.
So, Eric, take us back to the pitch of $2 Radio. Did you like bust into the room with a bunch of manuscripts and you're like, Eliza, we need to start a publishing company. You just got off work.
I know Eric was bartending at a Holiday Inn.
Yeah.
A Holiday Inn on the beach in San Diego.
I think that there's something magical about that period in your life where you can do things without a lot of foresight or like industry know-how. And if you're naive enough and idealistic enough, then you can just kind of like shoulder through all the various obstacles.
You just kind of assume things will work out at that age.
Yeah.
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 Which is definitely, we were like, we'll just do that.
We definitely didn't have like a business plan.
We did not have a business plan. We still don't have a business plan.
And we didn't have any money either. And it was like, I got in touch with John Martin, who started Black Sparrow Press. And so when I got in touch with him, I was like, this is really cool, this story thing, blah, blah, blah. Do you have any insight or advice? And he's like, well, you know, like I also had like $30,000, which I think in today's, at that time, like 2007, in 2007 would amount to something like $300,000.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh shit, like, well, we don't have that. So
I don't recall you telling me that.
I've always been the optimist.
Yes.
The two of us. So yeah, didn't want to concede that to Alexa.
Yeah. So yeah, we just kind of, all the ingredients were there, and then starting a indie press was the result of just everything falling into place.
Can you maybe talk about that process? I think, you know, we've been talking to a lot of this year so far. We've talked to musicians who go on tour and then start to wonder about kind of what does stability mean? How do I kind of chase this dream that I have of this kind of making it as a musician or as an artist? But also I have to like balance my life and like figure out how to get through that. And I'm wondering what that process or what that balance was like for you over the course of, you know, because my hunch is that you didn't kind of put out one book and then you were like, all right, done with the day job. Like we've done it. My sense is that was a process, and maybe you can talk about what that process looked like.
It was a process. And like I mentioned, we started a family at the same time. So, so basically I think it, Nat, we're going, this is our 17th year of having the press. And I think it maybe at year 10 or so, I think Eric was able to finally quit his night job. But so our process with running the press was Eric worked a night job, usually as a bartender managing a bar. And I had a day job at a corporate textbook publisher. So we would, because we, daycare, I don't know, do you guys have kids? Daycare is so expensive.
I don't, but I hear that it's very expensive.
Yeah, so we couldn't afford daycare. So he would watch the kids during the day and simultaneously work on the press. And then I would get home from work. Sometimes we would like just say hello to each other as we like passed each other to go, like I was getting home from work and he would go to work.
Yeah.
And then I would, you know, like do my copy editing tasks and whatever else needed to get done with the kids. So basically it could have been really easy at any point in the last 17 years to say like, this is too much. Like we need to stop, but we're just both so stubborn and willing to take on a lot of responsibility. Like each of us, we're both built that way. So it was just never an option to stop. And then finally, you know, once you build up enough of a backlist and keep putting out work that resonates with people, then I think the snowball just keeps getting bigger. So now we both work full time for the press, and, you know, we like chose to live in a place in a neighborhood that was extremely affordable. So it's like every decision we've made in our lives has been based around letting the press like grow and thrive, including moving to Ohio because the cost of living is cheaper than San Diego or New York City, one might imagine.
So. But I definitely think like a lot of what you're talking about can really feel daunting throughout that whole process, and has felt really daunting over the course of the last 17 years where, you know, we would, when we were starting out, especially, we had these different like milestones where it was like, man, we just got to get covered by the book publishing trade publications and then we'll be set. And then we got covered by those places. And then we're like, okay, once we get a major distributor, then we'll be set. You know, we'll be able to do this full time. And I would, you know, ask our friends who worked in the industry too, like, how long did it take you before? A lot of them said like 10 years. That was kind of like in the back of my mind. But, you know, another one of those milestones was like, man, we just got to get our books covered by major media and the New York Times. And, you know, like I so specifically remember like reaching a point where we were getting like most of our books during a certain period of like window of time we're getting covered by the New York Times. And, you know, we were still like working through the slog of like working till 3 a.m. and then like getting up with the kids in the morning and working on the press and stuff like that and juggling our kids and work. And so it's just been, it's really humbling to that whole process of, you know, having to, you know, sweep the floor at night in a bar after, you know, reaching this really extreme high of having a book get like a full page review in the New York Times. It's definitely like kept us very modest.
I think also starting out during the Great Recession, where it's just, we've always been like, even if there's money in our pockets, like we know we need to save it for a rainy day, you know, like there's no wasted money. Like we keep a really tight eye on our budgets because we've always had to. So yeah, there's definitely, you got to make a lot of sacrifices to build something from scratch. And if anyone had given me a crystal ball and said like, this is how hard it's going to be, we wouldn't have done it. But like, it was like, it's like boiling a frog, you know, it was just like, okay, now we need to do this. Okay, now we need to do this. So it's just like one foot in front of the other. And now like, I'm so thankful that we did it because it's really amazing what's been created and rewarding. And
it was, yeah, it was like 4 years ago, like 4.5 years ago when we reached a point where we were both able to work on it full time. Mm-hmm.
And then for some reason we opened a bookstore cafe. Well, that was actually,
don't do that.
No, it's wonderful. It's amazing. It's just, we seem to bite off a lot at a time. So now that's the store is turning 5 this year, which is pretty amazing because most of the time of it was in a pandemic.
Yeah.
But yeah, our kids work for us now. Our daughter's on the payroll. It's pretty cool. So it's a family press, obviously, but it really is like the 4 of us have been involved in it. The kids, because they were forced into it, but they're starting to realize it's cool.
Yeah.
So that's really nice.
Actually, and a really funny story, you know, so we published Hanif Abdurraqib's essay collection, They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us.
Yeah.
And so he's obviously huge.
Yeah.
Right now. And so at our daughter's high school, our daughter's 15, you know, they had this, they're doing a project on Hanif and like reading some of his books and stuff like that. And so they had the book and our daughter took a picture of the thing. And also, so our son who's in 6th grade, they had to do this Google Doodle for Black History Month. And there was one of his classmates was doing Hanif for their Google Doodle. And our son Maceo was like, I know Hanif. And his classmate didn't believe him. And he's like, yeah, my parents are friends with him. He's been at our house. And his classmate didn't believe him.
Yeah, I think that got us some clout.
Major clout. That's awesome. No, I love hearing that kind of story. I think Ben and I have been contemplating that very idea of like the dream versus reality, even with producing this podcast, especially this second season. I think for whatever reason, recording the first season, maybe because it was during like an earlier portion of the pandemic, it felt a bit more seamless to do, or maybe we had more time to do it. And, you know, now, you know, we're both working full-time jobs and like we're interviewing people while at work or whatever, and like trying to make things work. And like Eric, to your point of like getting the New York Times reviews and things like that, like finding those benchmarks, I think Ben and I have really been thinking about that and how we relate to the work that we're creating. Like, for instance, I mean, even like getting emails from y'all to interview authors for the podcast, like Ben said, we've been reading $2 books for years, and I wouldn't have imagined that we'd be like talking to you right now, you know, for instance, or like talking to other authors, like Gina Nutt, for instance, that was an amazing conversation. And I think it's really important just to show people like these things take time and it's not easy by any means.
Right.
Yeah, and a lot of commitment, like you're saying. Yeah. You could just be happily doing the work you have to do because you're at your job, you know, but on top of that, you're taking on this extra, what is work, even if it's fun work, for you, but that's how things get created. And then you just keep doing it for long enough. And then you have this beautiful thing that you've created. So yeah, very similar.
You know, I'm kind of curious. So you brought up Hanif, and I'm wondering how important that book was. Obviously big enough that like, I think that was the first one that I read. How important are, you know, to the company and to, you know, finding other books and being able to publish other books are kind of books that make it big. And how, I guess, like, yeah, when you're deciding like where to go or what to choose or what to take the risk on, how important are those kind of big books that blow up and become a part of a kind of broader conversation?
Well, that book was obviously like instrumental and foundational for us just in what it's allowed us to do and other books that we've been afforded the opportunity to publish as a result of that. I think that it gave us a lot of street cred too. There were some other books that were, really big hits for us before They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, like Scott McClanahan's Crapalacia, which is taught in universities and just continues to sell tremendously well. And is a book that really resonates with people and with writers too. And another one, just a year or two ago, Ocean Vuong did a list for Lit Hub about books that he needed to read in order to write On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. And one of the only contemporary works that he placed on the list was Crapalacia, which is about growing up in rural West Virginia. Another sort of like milestone for us was this book, The Orange Eats Creeps, by Grace Krilanovich, that received a recognition from the National Book Foundation. And it's about slutty teenage hobo vampire junkies. And Grace was compared a lot to William Burroughs and Kathy Acker. And it's just this really nervy, acerbic text. And the fact that it's gone on to sell like 10 to 15,000 copies is pretty incredible and exceeded our expectations for sure. But it's also like, it's under option with Mary Harron, who directed and adapted American Psycho. And she's planning on it being her next project that she comes out with. So hopefully it's a movie really soon too. But that's another one in this conversation for Lit Hub that Emily St. John Mandel and Laura Vandenberg had with one another. They both pointed at that book is like one of the books that they keep coming back to, and writers whose work that they're excited to read new work from. Grace Kalanovich. So Hanif, they can't kill us until they kill us was, I mean, like we've got like 70,000 copies in print, I think at this point. And, you know, it's shown up in like, music videos, and ESPN is adapting one of the essays into like a short film, and it's a question on the ECTs. So it's just it's wild.
It's pretty special.
It's insane.
But that's what the crazy thing about publishing is, like, we don't have a crystal ball, and neither does anybody else in the industry. So there are some things that you can kind of know, like if the author is really outgoing, like for example with Hanif, like he relentlessly toured the country because he's a poet, so his stage presence is just magical, and so he worked so hard to like get himself to where he is, where his travel schedule was insane. He was constantly traveling and doing events, so it's just you. And then there's some books that we publish that we're just kind of like kind of shocked that they don't do well, like do well in terms of just sales numbers, you know, like how many copies moved. So it's just, you just never know what's going to really take hold. Like the book, The Orange Eats Creeps, if you go to Goodreads and look at the reviews, it's like all one star and all five stars. It's like people hate it with a passion or love it with a passion. So it's, when we published that book, we didn't know it was going to be one of our top sellers for like, you know, our history.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I think I'm wondering if, oh, is there a tension between, oh, is this something where you're like, this is more marketable, this is more, you know, consumable, this is easier. You know, I was reading a couple months back, The Vine That Ate the South, a book that I really loved, but I was like, I cannot imagine this being published anywhere else. And so I'm like, you know, is there ever that tension there? Or are you just like, these are the books that we want to take chances on? And so like,
just like your podcast that you're creating, it's kind of like, if you, the Field of Dreams, like if you build it, they will come. So you've built your thing and you're going to attract people that are into the thing you're doing. And we've built this thing that is very like, people can see what we're doing and are attracted to it. So I think in part we have somewhat of a loyal reading, like a reading base, like people who have read a few of our books and have liked them, like continue to come back because they're curious, you know, what else we're going to do. So we take that really seriously and try to have like a no wasted bullets, you know, like make sure everything we put out is like this top level, like our expectation of excellence.
Which is good for us in terms of our relationship, in terms of just like being a married couple and not having any kind of like bullshit filter. It's just like, if Eliza is like living with me, like I will not hear the end of it.
Because there's just no room for error. So my point is, if we publish a book that, like Yelena Moscovitch is one of my favorite authors on this planet, and we have had the good fortune of publishing two of her three novels. And I think we actually wanted to publish the first one, but it got placed with someone else. But then we got Virtuoso and it came out January before the pandemic. So like not great timing. And then we published her second or her third novel last year. And she's brilliant. I really hope that she finds her place at the top of like literary giants quickly, because I believe that she is, but it's super edgy and confident and in some ways experimental, especially the last one. So in order for us to run a business, we have to sell copies, right? And so it's like, it's really, we're in a good position because we have a loyal reading base. So we know that we can get them like interested in a book like that is outside of kind of like the normal safe books to read, I guess. I don't know if I'm expressing myself well.
I think that, you know, we go into it, like I've said it on a couple occasions that I think that, you know, like 20, 30 years from now, Yelena Moscovitch is like going to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. Like she's one of those just incendiary talents, just absolutely brilliant, mind-blowing work. But is someone like I don't know. I mean, it's surprising to us a lot of times. We go into every book like thinking like, this is brilliant. 100% behind this. This deserves to win the National Book Award. And then, you know, like, so it's shocking when like we don't have six books win the National Book Award every year. But, you know, it's just one of those things, you know, it's like the Field of Dreams thing, like Eliza was saying, you just throw enough stuff out there that
what you're doing.
Yeah. And we've never published a book because we thought, like, specifically because we thought, oh, this is going to sell well. It always has to be like a $2 radio book.
Yeah, it's actually the opposite. Like we just kind of, a book we're worried about turning a profit on, because we have such a long track record now, we know how much it costs to, you know, like do a a print run. I mean, there are certain fixed costs, you know, like a barcode costs $25. Like every book has that built in. So a book that we know financially, it's probably not going to be our like bestseller for the year. We just make changes for how we publish it so that to reduce the costs as much as possible so that we can publish it and not hurt ourselves like financially, you know?
Yeah.
So.
And it is, I mean, The Origins Creeps was a good like early example for us in terms of like taking something on that we were like, oh man, are we ever going to break even on this? And then it's hugely successful, which I think was a valuable lesson for us to learn. But I think in terms of there is an added layer of stress now in terms of like having employees. And it's like, we need to make enough money to keep the lights on, to keep our employees paid so that we can afford to eat too. And things like that.
Yeah. All of our, it's definitely different when you give up your day job, because all of the eggs are in this basket.
Yeah.
You know? So we're, yeah. And like Eric was saying, there's no bullshit filter. Like we're really hard on each other.
Yeah.
But in a productive way, not in like a bad way. You know, it's like decisions have to be made. Sometimes they're hard decisions.
Yeah.
And there's time constraints on everything.
Hmm.
So yeah, we really never stop working because we live in the same house. So sometimes discussions, you know, from earlier in the day come back to life after dinner.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, your point, Eliza, about like you've built up this audience that you can take risks on certain novels or collections and know that you can kind of get people bought into it. I think it's so true. Like I can say for sure $2 Radio is like the one, like Eric, to your point of like looking at the logo instead of the author's name. Like whenever you guys have those sales, that's like five books or whatever for how much, I always buy them. Like I probably have like 20 plus $2 Radio books. And it's because of what you're saying, Eliza, like I just know that the work is going to be challenging and experimental and interesting on a formal level. And that's what I'm interested in. So I'm okay with like not knowing who the author is and just knowing that the book is going to be something I like because y'all like it. And I something that is really interesting to me that Gina Nutt actually brought up and you all have talked about a bit is that if I'm remembering correctly, Night Rooms was an unsolicited submission, and which is just wild to me thinking about just like how amazing that manuscript is. I'm curious like why it's important for you all to keep that avenue open, because I think at least from what I've seen, it's not like that common for publishers to be like, oh, we're just going to allow the floodgates to be open and whatever comes in, comes in.
I mean, it's super important to us to continue to accept unsolicited submissions. And there really aren't that many publishers, I guess, our size who do that. Most of them might have like a very specific reading window when they do open it up to unsolicited submissions. But I think that when you think about agents as, you know, in terms of what they want to take on, they're interested in what they can sell. And they're going to make more money if they sell it to a big publisher. So that is the agent submissions that we tend to get seem to follow one of two tracks. Either they're super invested in the author's career and totally believe in that author and think that we would be a good starting point for the author over, and then, you know, eventually like sell to a larger press for more money. Or the second track is they've already submitted to all these big publishers and they've all said no. And so that doesn't necessarily mean it's perfect for us. And some of the best work that we've ended up taking on has been unsolicited submissions, and some of our best-selling books too, in terms of like The Orange Eats Creeps. I mean, I would say during the course of a year, like 50% roughly, give or take, comes from like unsolicited submissions.
Wow.
Book Found Audio, is one of like the dark horse on our list. I think we've gone through like 3 or 4 printings and probably like 6 or 7,000 copies. And that was an unsolicited submission. The Deeper the Water, the Uglier Fish by Katia Apakinya. That's another like dark horse for us. Like, I think we just got back the 4th printing today. She submitted it to us like unsolicited, even though she's got one of the most high profile agents. So the agent like chopped it around or whatever. And I don't think she thought he was whatever.
We should say not to poo poo on, but
so then she submitted it directly to us through our submittable. And that was how we encountered it. And then another book that's doing tremendously well for us right now that is unfortunately really timely is I Will Die in a Foreign Land.
Yeah.
By Flani Picard. And you know, that was one that came to us unsolicited too. And I think that we have that reputation as being willing to work with authors. And so sometimes in terms of the unsolicited submissions, there's a bit more elbow grease that goes into it. But it's worth it for us.
Maybe one of the final questions, just because you mentioned it, and I wanted to get you to talk about it briefly, is like, you know, you're also talking about being in the midst of a series of crises, right? Like the 2008 financial crisis being the start of the press. We've got the COVID pandemic. We've got, you know, and you were also talking about like how there's always been this conversation around, oh, the death of print. And actually, I think I was just reading an article a couple of years ago that was like, oh, it's not going to be ebooks. It's going to be audiobooks now. And so I'm wondering, like, where you, like, you know, the press has obviously grown and survived. And, you know, I think you're showing that people really do love this kind of personal touch. But like, how do you position yourselves and how do you see yourselves in this world that is kind of moving from crisis to crisis in a lot of ways?
Well, I think 2018 was supposed to be the year that ebook sales and print sales were supposed to be 50-50. I mean, that's what they were saying in 2010, was that, you know, it would take about 10 years. Obviously that didn't happen. I mean, for us, I think it's still probably like 95% or so like physical books versus ebooks that are sold. And it's just, I mean, I'm just trying to think of the name. A bookseller of Romans years ago, Patrick Brown, you know, he had this point where it's just like a book has been around for centuries and it's a perfect technology. And it's like, it really is. Like you can hold it in your hands, you can flip the page. And I don't think it can be improved on. Yeah, it doesn't need to be charged. It doesn't waste like unique vital resources from the earth. And the, you know, you can plant more trees and things like that and print on recycled paper. But it really is just sort of like the perfect technology. Whereas if you think about music delivery devices or audiobooks, something like that, those are things that are just constantly being tweaked and improved, and it's like recent technology. So you know, it's not necessarily like apples to apples, like ebooks to, or I guess like books to Spotify, I guess,
right,
or something like that.
So we've never really worried about, we've never seen ebooks as like an issue, because what we've built, the company is based on what we like.
Yeah.
So we like to read physical books. We don't read on devices. I do really like audiobooks myself, but we do like Gina Nuts. Gina and I made the audiobook together.
Yeah.
She recorded, we sent her a mic. She recorded it in her closet and then I mastered it on freeware. So, you know, it's like we definitely embrace the different channels, like audio, ebook, but our bread and butter is the physical object that we like both revere. So.
But I think in terms of navigating crises, I guess really it's just focusing on what we can control, which is just making the book the best possible thing that it can be, the work and working with the writer to edit it and trying to find stories that are interesting and appealing to readers too, and not necessarily focusing on trends, I guess, in the industry.
But sadly, the biggest problem, that really the biggest stressor for us right now, is the like rapidly just like insanely rapid increase in prices because of the supply chain issues. So the cost of paper, there's glue shortage, there's paper shortage, there's all of the big presses that you usually print overseas in China, because the cost of and the cargo issues during COVID, they stopped printing over there and brought their printings to North America where we print. So they've flooded all the printers. So like not only is the cost of the product going up, but the wait lines are longer. So our biggest issue right now is just like the sticker price on books has to go up. There's no other option. So that's kind of like the biggest, like going forward, that's the thing that is going to affect us the most, not like different formats, but just the cost of the product itself.
There's something to be said too, like for us as consumers, you know, being willing to accept something at a higher value because of the work that and acknowledging the work that goes into it. And I'm okay with that in terms of like what I purchase, whether that be like food at a restaurant or piece of art or something like that. And I think if you look at the prices on some things, they haven't been allowed to go up much of the last 17 years since we started, you know, like books haven't really increased in cost while everything else has because of Amazon, things like that. So it's, you know, a give and take. It would be nice to see like books achieve sort of like their due value in our culture.
Which they do in other countries. So it's just kind of like, that's the next phase, I think, for not just us, but publishing as a whole.
Well, something on a completely unrelated note, something I had to ask was, I saw a funny video that you all recorded with your kids. I think it was like your kids interviewing Eric or something like that. And it got me thinking, just like, I feel as like, you know, you read interviews with musicians, like famous musicians or authors or whatever. And when it comes to the kids are like, oh, I don't listen to the music, or like, I don't care about what my parents do. Obviously your kids, you know, work for you all at $2, but I'm curious, like, what is their relationship to the business and books and reading? Are they avid readers, or do you find that, how do they relate to it?
They are avid readers. They both excel at reading, and, you know, they get tested like 10 million times a year at schools. So they're very high levels of reading, and they really love reading, which is the whole point of all of it. We've been trying to get our kids, especially our older one, because of the maturity level, to read some of our books, some $2 radio books, which I can't tell if there's a little bit of resistance to that, or if it's just that our books are not meant for 15-year-olds, you know. But they definitely, like we touched on, they're definitely respecting what we do and realize that it's something for them to be proud of.
There are definitely times too where we'll get in the weeds talking about it, like while we're sitting outside or something, and our son will just be like, all right, I'm going inside now.
And sometimes, I mean, he's only 11, but sometimes he'll, like, we were arguing about the best way to track something, and I wanted to use a calendar as the tool, and Eric wanted to use a spreadsheet as the tool, and we were going back and forth. I was saying my reasons, and he was saying his reasons, and our son was just like standing watching us, and he was like, why don't you just do it both ways? So he, like, you know, was trying to solve our problem for us. So I think for them, it's just kind of like, it's always been there, you know. It's like kind of like a third child.
I can't imagine them, you know, like in some of the early memories of our son, like coming out, like he had trouble with pronunciation, but he called it $2 radio. And I mean, like that there, and we had these like temporary tattoos, and they would put them all over their body and stuff like that. So I guess, yeah, it really is just a physical presence in their lives, and maybe emotional presence too. But in the recent past, I guess, like seeing some of the stuff where it's like our books appearing on the news, they might not acknowledge it quite as much with us, to us, but they seem to be taking a little pride in it, which is cool.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting as they enter adulthood, because they both kind of have careers picked out, but our daughter works on the weekends at the bookstore as a kind of like running food and taking orders and interacting with people who are in our space. And really, really, really loves that experience and kind of, you know, looks forward to it. So like when given the chance to hang out with a friend instead, our daughter will choose to go to work. So, I mean, I feel like that says something for 15 years.
That's a good sign.
And I think it's because there's a little bit of a status thing there, you know, like we are, people are coming to our space because they like what we've built. So people are coming there, seeking us out. And it's kind of, I think, fun for our children to be a part of that. But I don't know if they're going to work for us when they're older. We'll have to.
Well, Ben, do you have anything else?
I don't. I was going to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, we appreciate it. It was really great to talk to you guys too.
And that was our conversation with Eric and Eliza Obanoff about $2 Radio, how it came to be, what they're doing now, why it's important to have kind of unsolicited submissions in a industry that has kind of, you know, gotten rid of that. Really cool conversation. And I don't know about you, Ben, but it kind of gave me a little bit of hope in terms of like, oh, maybe like the work I'm working on, I can place it somewhere, whether it's $2 Radio or, you know, a place kind of like theirs.
Yeah, 100%. I think like talking to people who are like, oh, actually we go out of our way to find stuff that is going to stick with you and to kind of be weird enough or experimental enough or say something strongly enough that it's going to impact you, that as a reader, you're going to stick around with it. I really just love that ethos too. I think Eric kind of talks a little bit about it, and Eliza touches on it too. But this idea that you like can't predict what's going to blow up, like you can't really know like what are the books that are going to pop off, I think really stands out for me. That, you know, as a publisher, they're kind of saying, listen, there's no real way to know what books are going to make it big and what books are going to, you know, kind of fizzle out. And so in some ways, like that's an incentive to make these bets on books that are, you know, strange or weird or different that you can't find anywhere else, because, you know, like A, why not? But B, also like then you want stuff that people are going to, you know, want to talk about because it is so different and it is so challenging that people will be like, oh, hey, I haven't seen this elsewhere. I just think it's an interesting way of approaching, you know, how do you make guesses about like what's worth publishing?
Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, there's a part in the conversation where Eric is talking about how like their ethos in some ways with publishing is that it's almost like a music, like a record label, where like an indie record label where, you know, even if you don't necessarily know who the author is, the kind of intentionality behind it is that, you know, the readership trusts Eric and Eliza's tastes in that it's going to be a good book. It's going to be experimental. It's going to be like something they haven't experienced before. And I think they really do deliver on that. Cause I can just speak personally, you know, throughout the year they do these sales where they'll be like, get five of our books for like $20 or so dollars. And like dead ass every time I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm getting five books. And it really is because I'm like, okay, I've read a couple of their books and I know that whatever the case may be, it's going to be a book that I'm not used to, like in terms of the structure. Like I can think of like My Volcano, like that book, like 100%. Have never experienced anything like it, probably won't experience anything like it, except by a press, like $2 Radio, or like another book of theirs that we haven't had on the show, is Tariq Shah's Whiteout Conditions. It's like a really short, brisk novel, like probably under 200 pages long, hyper-focused and really inventive. You know, books like that are ones that you're not going to really see in these bigger publishers, and I wouldn't necessarily pick out if they were from those bigger publishers. I think kind of having a somebody like $2 Radio stamp of approval on there makes me okay with maybe taking a risk on a book that I normally would, you know, pass by in the bookstore.
Yeah. The other thing is I think they dovetail so well with our emergent theme this season, which is about you know, the dream and how much work goes into kind of trying to make stuff like this get off the ground and how long that takes. I mean, so on this round, you kind of hear Eliza talking about that they've been working on this press for 17 years. And I think it took them about a decade for Eric to be able to quit his night job. I think he talks about working night shifts in order to be able to start working full time on this project, which is like such a massive commitment, right? And I think it's just like another example of like just how much work sometimes goes into the effort of like getting some of this stuff off the ground.
Yeah. I mean, 100%. I think all the people we've talked to this season have validated our own thoughts around that. But I think especially this conversation, it's like, one, it's a staggering thought to think they've spent over a decade before they could get to a point where, you know, they could do that full time. But also too, it's like it's ended up being worth it in the end. And without, you know, looking at it with rose tinted glasses, I think that they are pretty honest about like, if we could go back, we probably wouldn't do this thing, I think is what they said. So just like thinking about that and how, you know, this kind of choice they ended up making while difficult has ended up kind of producing a life that feels fulfilling for them, I think is so cool. So yeah, this conversation was really great to have, and one that it was just kind of validating in terms of like, hey, here's this essentially this brand now that I've liked for all these years from afar, and getting to meet the people behind it, and it turns out, hey, they're just as cool as this thing that they're making. So yeah, I just really appreciated being able to you know, shoot the shit with them for a little bit and kind of learn a little bit more about their lives and how they've made this publisher that I really like you know, a thing.
Yeah, 100%. Phil, anything else?
No, I mean, I think, as always, if you enjoyed the show, definitely follow it on like Spotify, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, and, you know, give those 5-star ratings, even if you don't end up leaving a written review, which you should. The reviews help in terms of getting more people, seeing the show on their app and, you know, all that jazz. I'm sure you hear this on every podcast, so I won't belabor the point, but yeah, the reviews help. And more importantly, I think Ben and I really like hearing from you all. So if you ever want to drop us a line, whether it's just a question or an insight or a reaction to an episode, definitely do that by sending us either like over Twitter at @OriginStory_ or at our email, which is theoriginstorypod@gmail.com. You can also find all this information at our website, which is originstory.show.
Thanks as always to Ryan Hopper for our intro and our outro music, Melody Hirsch for all the design work that she's been doing for Origin Story. You can find me at @sad_radio_lad. Phil, where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter at 3D Cisco, like the musician, on Twitter. And yeah, in terms of $2 Radio, $2radio.com, as well as on all social stuff at $2 Radio. Again, I think that their books are really great. Some off-the-cuff recommendations would be, yeah, My Volcano by John Elizabeth Stinsey, Night Rooms by Gina Nutt, And another one I really liked was Some of Us Are Very Hungry Now by Andre Perry. Ben, I don't know if you have others you might want to recommend.
I really liked The Vine That Ate the South, which is just a really, really well-written book, kind of Southern Gothic, worth checking out if that sounds like your jam at all. I also checked, just because we always do, like, what's the latest release with all of our folks. Obviously a much longer list because this is a publisher, but they do have a $2 radio guide to vegan cooking, which just released. And as a reminder, I think they talked about it briefly, but they have a vegan restaurant as part of their pub, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, 100%. I'd love, like, when I lived in Ohio, I never actually got to visit the store. So, you know, at some point in time, Ben and I, we're going to have to do a live recording at $2 Radio. They already offered. So, one day.
Time for us to do a grub tour. Origin Story Food Edition.
Yeah, I'm ready. So, yeah, thanks again for listening to the episode. And, yeah, we'll be back here again with the next episode of Origin Story.